I mean, as you know, my approach to biography is not so much the fascination or a sort of psychological analysis of the person. It's like, what can they tell us about the world that they lived in? What can they tell us about the movements that they were a part of? And how can that be made more real to a reader by telling it through someone's life? And so she had a lot of stories to tell.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome, everybody. We're going ahead and getting started. This is being live streamed, so there's a little camera there if people are interested in knowing what that is. But I want to welcome everybody. My name is Dana Blanchard. I work here at Haymarket Books, and I want to welcome everyone to Haymarket House and to our wonderful event tonight on Eslanda S. E. Cordoza Good Robison, which is a lovely, long, beautiful name. She lived a colorful and amazing life, yet for many of us, she's lived in the shadows of her husband. And been seen as Mrs. Paul Robeson. And thank you to Dr. Barbara Ransby, who wrote an amazing biography of Essie, bringing her story into the light for all of us to enjoy. So I'm going to introduce our two speakers and then get out of the way and let them have a conversation about Essie and other incredible Black women in history. So Dr. Barbara Ransby is a widely acclaimed historian of the Black Freedom Movement. She's an award-winning author and a longtime activist. Most of us in this room know the incredible work she's done in Chicago activism. Her book, Eslanda, of course, is the reason we're here tonight. So I encourage everyone to get a copy and also get her to sign it before you leave tonight. So one of the things that impresses me most about Dr. Ransby is your incredible ability to tell stories and particularly write biographies of amazing, inspiring Black women. So it is one of your many gifts. And in Eslanda, she shines a light on Essie and shares with all of us why she is one of the most important figures in the 20th century. She will be joined in this conversation. We're very honored to have Dr. Lynette Jackson, who is an associate professor of gender, women's studies, and Black studies at University of Illinois, Chicago. She also does amazing work researching and writing about incredible Black women and children internationally. She's working on a forthcoming book, a critical biography of Winnie Mandela, which I think might also be discussed tonight. So thank you all for joining us in what will be a rich conversation in person and online. So thank you. Thank you.
So I guess I'll start.
Please do.
I'm really happy to be here, happy to see all of you, and happy to see this beautiful new space, and happy that Haymarket is reissuing Eslanda, this biography of what Eslanda, the Large and Unconventional Life of Mrs. Paul Robeson. And I'm also excited because I read the full book front to back. I had read little sections of it before, but in preparation for this.
Special prize for doing
it. I read it front to back, and I'm really glad I did. It was a very rewarding experience, and I'm just going to really briefly talk about three reasons why it was such a rewarding experience, and then I'm going to move into asking Barbara some questions about the book. So this was a great read. It's a very rich and rewarding book, and I had three reasons. It was rewarding because it was so well researched and so full of Eslanda's agency in the world and view of the world and key struggles of the 20th century, struggles against fascism, imperialism, racism, colonialism, through the prism of a Black internationalist, an anthropologist, a Pan-Africanist, feminist-inclined, pro-communist Black woman writer and activist. But the key thing was just the agency and the way that her agency was centered in terms of understanding and interpreting the world, but also creating history herself. The other reason that was really exciting, one of the reasons I really enjoyed the book, is because I teach Black feminist biography at UIC, and I'm currently myself researching a biography of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, an extraordinary and complicated, uncompromising, unapologetic freedom fighter who was centrally, though not only or exclusively, the wife of a famous Black man, Nelson Mandela. Both Islanda and Wendy struggled to maintain a sense of self and independence from being overshadowed by their larger-than-life men. And both played a central role in their husbands' careers. But they lived very complicated lives. And so reading Islanda's biography, I could really connect to it on those levels. And then finally, because I'm an African historian, and this book, while written by an American historian, Barbara Ransby, is so full of rich insights and details about Africa, particularly in the sort of early anti-colonial period, and the sort of post-World War II era also. So very rich in African details mm-hmm. and context. This isn't one of my three reasons, but it was also like reading a who's who of Black internationalism, Black cultural life in the 1920s and 30s, the Third World Movement post-Van Dung, anti-colonialism, Black Pan-Africanist feminism. We read about people like Claudia Jones, Shirley Graham Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois, Kwame Nkrumah, and on and on and on. But you read about so many people who were, but it wasn't just about name dropping. And I know Barbara would never do that, but it was really because, but it was also because her life intersected with so many people from all over the world.
Yeah.
Henry Wallace, Nehru, Emma Goldman, I mean, on and on and on, Zora Neale Hurston. So the first question I'd like to ask you, Barbara, is on top of all of the history that Islanda witnessed and opined upon, as well as made herself, you described her as having a well-preserved life, for instance, which I thought was really powerful. And you wrote, she made sure of it. She marked her journey, maintained and saved voluminous correspondence and news clippings, published her thoughts and ideas as widely as she could, and saved many of her public speeches and private diaries. So while this is terrific, and as somebody trying to write a biography of a Black woman who, like Islanda, didn't identify as a feminist, but I'm sort of identifying her in that way, this is a terrific opportunity. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, why do you think, and this may seem like an odd question, but why do you think Islanda was so committed mm-hmm. to having such a well-preserved life or mm-hmm. documenting her life?
Creating her own archive.
Yeah.
I will answer that. But let me just also say, by way of kind of opening, you know, thank you for doing this. And Lynette and I met many, many years ago when she was living in Zimbabwe. And kind of, I always think of you as my introduction to the continent. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote a book about somebody that spent a lot of time on the continent, I, of course, think of you and your work. And thanks to Haymarket Books for giving Islanda a new lease on life and a new audience. And I can't thank the press enough for all the wonderful work that you do for this space, for the books that you're putting out into the world, and for the cover of this book, which, as you all know, as the folks at the press know, was my preferred image of her, you know, in command, happy, looking quite worldly, I think, in all her glory. So anyway, so the question about how or why did she preserve her records in such a way? I mean, it's a contrast between her and, say, Ella Baker, who I also wrote mm-hmm. a book about. Ella Baker, I mean, it was a chore to find anything. You know, she wrote documents and didn't put her name on them. She had things in shoeboxes and, you know, kind of all of that. And I have often said about Islanda, you know, it was like she was leaving crumbs in the snow, which I had to be cautious of as well, because is she saying, this is how I want you to write my story, or is this like the documents I would find anyway? I think she was really concerned about telling her story and amplifying her own voice for a couple of reasons. One you allude to in, you know, in the introduction, which is to say she lived in Paul's shadows. I mean, her entire life, she was Mrs. Paul Robeson. And so I think that was a fight to make sure her side of things was heard, to make sure that, you know, she didn't get drowned out or put in the shadows by Paul's very, very large presence. The other is political. You know, a good part of both of their lives was being persecuted and repressed during the McCarthy era. And really, in a sense, she's also been blacklisted in history. I mean, there are a lot of pantheons of Black internationalist women, and she's not there because she took controversial positions, some of which I, you know, disagree with myself. But I think she felt this erasure even in her own time. And so she was speaking truth to the future. Here's my story. Somebody will tell it. I mean, things were meticulously documented and labeled. Not only her life, but Paul's life, too. And we would not have had Duberman's, you know, imperfect but voluminous biography of Paul Robeson, Paul Robeson Jr.'s biography of his father. All of that was made possible by her preservation of their collective, you know, documentation. So I think those are a couple of the reasons, you know, both to amplify her voice as a woman who had often been, you know, kind of pushed to the side. And the other was to make sure that because of anti-communism, she wasn't erased from the larger history.
Thank you. I mean, I think about people like Ida B. Wells or Pauli Murray and people who, if they didn't write their own stories, the stories probably wouldn't have been told.
The funny thing I have to say is, you know, I did a lot of, there's wonderful photos that I'm happy, you know, are still in the book. But when I was doing photo research, there was at least one photograph of her, which had been published in a book. One photograph of Paul, I'm sorry, that had been published in another book, in which the actual photograph, she's in the photograph, and it gets cropped in a way in which she's out of the photograph, right? So I'm thinking the archive that she left was to make sure she wasn't cropped out of the larger Robeson story, you know? Yeah.
Well, this is kind of a follow-up, I think, particularly to what you just said, and that is, what led you to choose to write a history of this particular figure?
Well, I was just sitting around one day. What am I going to do with myself? Well, I had discovered her kind of accidentally when I was in college in New York, and I was doing research for somebody else. I was a graduate. I wasn't even a graduate student. I was undergraduate researcher for Hollis Lynch, who was, do you know Hollis Lynch? The father of filmmaker Shawa Lynch, who people may know more of this generation. And I came across the Robeson file. So there are Robeson papers at the Schomburg. It's not an extensive collection. The main collection is at Moreland Spingarn at Howard. And then there's another collection in Berlin and a small collection at Rutgers. So I was there, and I was taking a break from my paid research gig. And I was looking at some other, you know, collections, and there were, you know, there were papers, and she was, some of her articles were there. And I had not known very much about Paul Robeson's wife. And, you know, you start to discover someone, you're like, why don't I know about this person? So that was my, the beginning of my curiosity about her. I wrote an article when I was still an undergraduate about her, which I don't remember what was published in. You know the article?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I don't think very many people read it, but I did write it, and I was, you know, I kind of wanted to know more. So when I was thinking of what would my next project be, you know, she came to mind. And I wanted to talk about Black internationalism, you know, and she was the perfect vehicle to do that. I mean, as you know, my approach to biography is not so much the fascination or a sort of psychological analysis of the person. It's like, what can they tell us about the world that they lived in? What can they tell us about the movements that they were a part of? And how can that be made more real to a reader by telling it through someone's life. And so she got a lot of stories to tell.
Right.
Yeah. So that was it.
And it was definitely fun. What you feel like reading this book.
Yeah.
I mean, you're sort of traveling through the world and all these different movements through her eyes.
No, it was kind of fun to, to write about. I mean, I discovered people like Ada Bricktop Smith, who I hadn't known about, who was a saloon owner in Paris and been in Rome. Yeah. This woman had been a vaudeville entertainer. I mean, she wasn't all that political, but she was pretty colorful and interesting. So it kept, her life was interesting and eclectic enough that it kept my attention for the years I had to do the research and write it. As I'm sure Winnie will keep you quite interested.
Yes, and I imagine engaged. Years.
Years. Yeah.
So I think you one of the other things that was really important to telling the story is talking about both Eslanda and Paul's, but obviously focusing on Eslanda's sort of political coming of age and radicalization. I mean, she didn't start off radicalized, and there certainly are in the early chapters, maybe even some examples of, for lack of a better word, not completely woke, attitudes. But, I don't know if you want to talk a bit about that process of radicalization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a time when, the world was, so much was happening in the world. It's like, every period really probably can say that. But they left the United States before World War II. And so, I often say she left as a kind of respectable Negro woman, and she came back as a Black radical internationalist. And it's her experiences in the world, in London, where she met this, enormously interesting, radical group of folks from all parts of the British Empire, traveling to the Soviet Union, traveling to Africa. Her eyes were opened about the world and her place in it. And so, it's through the people that she met, through the relationships she built. You mentioned, some of those people at the outset, but meeting the African intellectuals and independence freedom fighters in London, when she was at the London School of Economics, she meets Jomo Kenyatta and introduces Paul Robeson to Jomo Kenyatta, by the way. That really had an enormous impact on her life. And going to the continent in 1936, which was a hell of a thing. You think of a Black woman going pretty much by herself to colonial Africa at a time when travel is very difficult, but also, just the weight of a white supremacist system, shrouding the continent. So so all of that really transformed her thinking about who she was, who she wanted to be in the world.
Right. I mean, she's a Black woman traveling to Africa during that time. She's taking boat rides down the Congo River. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something about it. I'm not going to say it's a disconnect, but it was a little surprising just how adventurous she was.
Mm-hmm. Well, at one point when she's traveling in the Congo, and that's in 1946, she's going to the interior of the country, and she's in French controlled Congo, and then she's in Belgian controlled Congo. She's going further into the continent, into the country, and she has to get on smaller and smaller planes. Mm-hmm. And so she has to leave a suitcase here, a typewriter here. And she's, and so that to me was also symbolic of, her stretching herself way beyond the comfort level that she was used to as a fairly privileged Black woman in her usual life. Yeah.
No, I mean, I've had a lot of adventures also traveling to different parts of Africa, but this was
stories.
The 80s, not the 40s.
Right.
And I never had to wash my hair with turpentine, which apparently she had to do.
That's in her diary.
So let's talk about the topic of feminism. Mm-hmm. You say a couple times, you make it clear that she didn't identify as a feminist. I don't know if she ever said that or if that's just something that you never encountered. So
I mean, and not many people of her time did, right? But like when we talk about intersectionality, I just in my class the other day was giving a lecture on intersectionality, and I said, there was a practice before there was a label. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, Eslanda was speaking about women's issues. She was living a very untraditional life. She was incorporating women's, you know, demand for women's freedom and equality into what she was writing as she traveled, right? Mm-hmm. She sought out women and amplified their voices. And so to me, those are markers of feminism, even without the label. But I didn't want to put a label on her, as I didn't with Ella Baker, mm-hmm. that she herself didn't embrace. But I say she's in a feminist tradition, a Black feminist tradition.
And I think you use like proto-feminist, nascent feminist.
Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
I did write the book 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So no, I know.
Page 211.
But related to this, I think, you know, I'll connect this conversation with her, the obvious importance to her to maintain her name, Mrs. Paul Robeson, and that connection as a source of yeah. access and entree around the world. And I guess maybe talk a bit about that. There's this, yeah, I don't want to get into this theories of like patriarchal bargain where, you know, on the one hand, you may be a feminist and sort of cringe at being associated with a man and not being recognized in your own light, but also some practical decisions about, well, but without this name,
yeah,
would I have the access that I have? So I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I thought a lot about the title because very few people in my world are Mrs. anybody, mm-hmm. right? So I thought, but she used it as an entree. And I think I say somewhere in there, you know, she said, this is Mrs. Paul Robeson, as a way to get a response from people, as a way to get access to meetings, to interviews, to other kinds of things, because they knew the name Robeson. But once the door opened, she walked in as Islanda and, you know, not accompanied by Paul, not mentioning Paul, not, you know, invoking Paul, et cetera. And I think she really felt that they had a partnership, and increasingly their marriage was less of a traditional marriage and it was more a business relationship and a comradeship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she felt that she would be, she would get less credit for what she had invested in that partnership. She would get less recognition as a, you know, political person in her own right if she didn't have the name, if she didn't use the name. Mm-hmm. I think she didn't really necessarily feel like she was using his name after a while. She felt like it was her name.
Right, I made this.
Yeah. And so she asserted it in that way. But there is a little contradiction there, a little tension there. But she wasn't going to let it go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She had earned to, you know, the right to be Mrs. Paul Robeson.
Right.
So she put that out there.
And in fact, at some stage she wanted a divorce. And she
Oh yeah. Well, you know, it was an open marriage of sorts. I mean, more open for him than for her in practice. But yeah, 1932, they were starting divorce proceedings. And that's actually a pivotal time for her. She goes to Paris in 1932 to get evidence for the divorce. This is before, you know, quote unquote, no-fault divorces. And in the process of getting evidence, that is hotel records of him being there with other people, which wasn't that hard to get. She encounters a lot of people, a lot of Africans living in Paris, Paulette, and Caribbean folks who are from the French-speaking Caribbean, Paulette Nardal, this guy, Kojo Tuvalu Hoinu, who is from Dahomey. And she is just swept away by all these conversations she's having, the literary circles that she's involved in. So I think that is really a year where she decides, I'm going to be different in this marriage and I'm going to be a different person in the world, whether we stay married or not. At that point, she thought divorce was going to happen. But anyway, they took a different path and they ended up staying married for, you know, decades more.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, A Revolutionary for Our Time, The Walter Rodney Story, by Leo Zelig. Walter Rodney was a scholar, working-class militant, and revolutionary from Guyana. Strongly influenced by Marxist ideas and living through numerous socialist experiments in the 1960s and 1970s, he remains central to radical Pan-Africanist thought. In this book, the first full-length study of Rodney's life, Leo Zelig critically considers Rodney's contribution to Marxist theory and history, and the contemporary significance of his work. As Olufemi O. Taiwo puts it, Through exacting research, exacting presentation, and careful analysis, Leo Zelig offers a remarkable contribution to radical thought and practice worthy of Walter Rodney's legacy. Find A Revolutionary for Our Time at haymarketbooks.org.
I mean, it is interesting, and it also made me think when I was reading this of, because working on Winnie Medizel Mandela, I mean, her marriage, obviously her husband was away and incarcerated for 27 years. So they spent very little time actually living together.
Very little,
less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still, you know, he was a bit paternalistic. I mean, there's evidence in the letters and things like that. And I guess my question is, how did you choose to address his philandering? And some might even say kind of selfishness relative to Islanda. I mean, mm-hmm. did you avoid making those kinds of?
I didn't intend to. I mean, you know, it's a special as you mm-hmm. again. I was happy to have this conversation with you because I think when you're doing biographies, a certain kind of relationship you have with the subject, right? I mean, part of it is a little voyeurism, like you are peeking into all these crevices of their lives. Sometimes you feel a little protective. You don't want them to be misunderstood because right. you've spent so much time together and all that. So sometimes what you're trying to do, you might not ultimately do. But I thought, you know, that I was, you know, being pretty candid about his I wouldn't be married to him. Let's just say that. you know, he was a celebrity. He was brilliant. He was gorgeous. He knew all that.
Right.
And he was a principled political person about many, many things and a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily describe him as a terrific husband or partner. So she made her peace with that. Right. She made her peace with that. So, yeah. And, you know, and took care of him really in a very generous, loving way when he became ill, you know, later in life, and didn't take care of herself as well as she took care of him, quite frankly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a central backdrop of this book, of course, is the Cold War. You know, combined with both Islanda and Paul's fondness for the Soviet Union, their pro-communism, even though they weren't communists, but in a time during the McCarthy era and everything where that was very, I'm trying to think of what my question is because that's...
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways to ask that. I can answer it without...
Do you want to speak? Okay, no, this is... Okay, you can say whatever you want.
I can answer it without a question mark.
But just about their relationship to the Soviet Union, particularly during that period of time.
Yeah. Well, and this is why, too, you know, I'm critical of that, right? So I think for a number of reasons. One is that they... And I would say that they were communists. They said they weren't members of the Communist Party. We don't even know if that was true or not. Mm-hmm. They were very close to the Communist Party, very close, Communist Party USA. And they believed in communism.
Right.
So I don't want to gloss over that.
Maybe they just told McCarthy they weren't communists.
Yeah, she did. She said, I don't know anything about it. What are you talking about? You're racist. But yeah, they believed in communism, as many people did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as
many black folks.
It did and do. I consider myself a socialist, mm-hmm. so I'm on that side of the spectrum, as you know. So they saw the Soviet Union as an ally of African independence movements. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that was very important. They saw the system that they, at least the part of the system that they saw when they visited the Soviet Union, as an alternative to the cutthroat greed and inequality of capitalism and the ravages of capitalism and so forth. And they had they developed a lot of personal ties.
And they saw it as anti-racist.
They saw it as anti-racist. Yeah. They saw it, and that wasn't the only thing though. They saw it as a system where workers were, you know, had some power. Now, I think, you know, when people want to have a model, you know, for their beliefs, it's easy to look the other way when those beliefs are not manifest in that particular place or system. And I think, you know, I don't know, honestly or dishonestly or self-delusional or, you know, whatever, for many reasons, a lot of people did not criticize the Soviet Union when it was clear that the Soviet Union did not embody the values that socialists and many communists hold dear. They ignored the repression and the purges and so forth. And I asked somewhat of a contemporary of Aslanda Robeson, a Black woman who had been in the Communist Party as well, you know, what did you all think during those times? And she said, well, it was a Cold War, and we believe that a lot of what they were alleging against the Soviet Union was just not true. Now, you know, after a certain point, you know, there was a lot of evidence that a lot of what was being said was true. And one can critique the Soviet Union and still have a critique of American, of U.S. capitalism, which we should all have. But they didn't do that. Right. So, yeah. Now, her, you know, in terms of the personal ties, she had two brothers who lived there. One lived there temporarily and another one who died there, you know, who lived there his whole life. So, you know, one person I interviewed speculated that she felt her brothers were vulnerable and she didn't want to make public criticisms because of that. I don't know that it was that simple.
Yeah. And just tell me why were her, I mean, and I understand the appeal of the Soviet Union during that period and communism for African Americans, particularly in the labor movement. So that's clear. But it wasn't clear why her brother was.
Well, a lot of people, you know, I mean, there were delegations that went there, artist delegations that went, W.E.B. Du Bois becomes a communist, dies in Ghana. Langston Hughes is a communist for a while. Richard Wright. Many people, many Black people saw the Soviet Union, you know, as a hopeful place on the planet.
Right.
So it's not surprising to me that they would go there. They do then make lives there. They the one brother marries a Russian woman and stays. So, yeah.
And with the backdrop of, you know, Jim Crow in the U.S. and colonialism everywhere else, it's not hard to understand. It was just still that he lived there so long.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe just one more question.
Okay.
And then we can open it up for folks to ask questions if they have any.
Okay.
You talk, I think on two occasions, you described Aslanda as unapologetic and certainly as fearless. And I think
it's
about
the title of our friend's book, Unapologetic. Charlene Carruthers' book. Yeah.
But also, I sort of picture her sitting in front of McCarthy and across from all of these, you know, white men and just holding her own. And what did she say? She said something like, all I ever feared were cats. So this is kind of fearless.
Yeah, that's something she says in an interview later. But she's, yeah, in 1953, she's called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And, you know, she thwarts their questions and their interrogation, you know, asking them, you know, I defend myself under the Fifth and the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment, of course, she's saying, Black people still can't vote in this country, so why should I cooperate with this this committee? And then they ask her about her book, African Journey, interestingly. And one of them leans over and asks her, did you write this book all by yourself? And that really set her off. You know, she's like, yes, I wrote this book. So she was a defiant personality. She was not somebody easily intimidated. She was a short woman, but she would often walk into a room and had a very commanding presence. So she wasn't going to be pushed around by Joe McCarthy. She was pretty strong. She didn't name names. She didn't cave. She didn't whimper. And it was a time when there were consequences, right? You know, people lost their jobs. People went to jail. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg had been executed. So you know, the stakes were high. So, you know, that's a measure of the kind of person she was. Not a perfect person, but she was damn tough.
Damn tough.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we want to open it up?
Yes, sure. I don't even know how long we've been talking, but...
I don't either.
That's all right.
Oh, all right. Only about 35 minutes.
Oh, okay. I should give my usual long-winded answers. People have any questions? Thank you all for coming. Any questions about Eslanda? Yeah, Steve.
Did she have any relationship with Ella Jo Baker?
She did not. She did not. That would have been a nice little connection, though, there, wouldn't it? Yeah. Both had December birthdays, that's all. But no relationship with Ella Baker. But as Lynette suggested, she had a relationship with almost everybody else that was her contemporary. I mean, she loved people, and she, you know, was quite the conversationalist, and people felt like they were being interviewed by her when she met them. So Zora Neale Hurston, for example, is one person she has a relationship with, and Zora Neale encourages her to go to the African continent. She says, you got to go. And she has this wonderful letter from her. So Emma Goldman, you mentioned, right, who she ends up parting ways with about the Soviet Union. You know, Emma Goldman is critical, and they have these letters. And at one point, the Robesons kind of, you know, take a distant position vis-a-vis Emma Goldman. And Emma Goldman writes a very pleading letter to them about their friendship. And, you know, that's the last exchange that we have. But no, she didn't know Ella Baker. But good question.
Can you talk about her upbringing growing up? Mm. How that affected her life?
Yeah. So she's born in D.C., and then she grows up in New York City. Her mother is an interesting and pretty formidable character. Father dies when she's young. Mother comes from a middle-class, light-skinned, black, middle-class family. But they get to Harlem, and her mother gets politicized. Her mother, who also has the name Eslanda. Apparently, this is a tradition in their family. The woman names, one woman in each generation gets named Eslanda for several generations back. But her mother becomes a part of the Liberty Leagues in Harlem that Hubert Harrison is the, you know, inaugurator of, and is in these socialist circles in Harlem, black socialist circles in Harlem at that time. So, you know, that's, their mother is a big influence on her. They have a somewhat tense relationship later on in life, but very much a part of her life, very much a role model for her. And she's close to her brother. She's the eldest, and is, you know, kind of grows up fast. Her mother works, her mother has businesses, and, you know, has a beauty business and this, that, and the other. So, yeah. And then she gets a degree in biology, actually, from Columbia. And this is another reason why being Mrs. Paul Robeson becomes a thing, because she gives up her career plans to become a scientist, kind of against the odds in terms of what was, you know, possible and open to black women at that time, to be Paul's manager and to really invest in his career in ways that she had not planned to before that. So that's a little about her background.
Well, thank you for, of course, writing this book and republishing it again. I'm curious, I have a couple questions, but I guess I'll start with, you spoke about why you do biography. And oftentimes, I've been in conversations about, like, why people do women's history, why people do black women's history. What do you think, and you said that you don't do it because you just want to, perhaps, like,
psychoanalyze a subject, yeah.
Exactly. You wrote out of individual or tell, like, a great person sort of history, but to talk about how this person can help us understand what's happening. So can you talk some more about that, particularly in thinking about the writings on black women in internationalism during this particular period of time? But what does Eslanda, her story, and your approach to her biography particularly add to the broader, like, historiography of this era?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it situates black women because she then has her whole cohort of all these, many of these other people that we're talking. Shirley Graham Du Bois is one important one who comes in. So I think we see black internationalism through a different lens, with different personalities coming into it in a different way. I think she, you know, the issue of McCarthyism and black socialists and communists are foregrounded in a different way by bringing Islanda into the mix. But I should also say this, it's not just about telling the story of the time. It's also, you know, there's something about flawed, and we're all flawed in one way or another, beautifully flawed, if we want to be generous, right? But, you know, about looking at an imperfect person's life. You know, here she's dealing with this complicated marriage and kind of struggling to have her voice. And she still makes really important historical contributions. You know, her writings about independence movements at that time, as an observer for the United Nations. I mean, she is at the founding of the United Nations. Right. She travels to China months after Mao Zedong's revolution. She is on the front lines of the Spanish Civil War writing a journal. She then meets many of the future leaders of the African National Congress in a conference in Bloemfontein in 1936. So she's kind of, you know, there's this, you know, character, John Reed, you know, in history, who's like always in all these places where history jumps off. So in a way, she's like that. But she's a person that has self-doubt. She's a person who is, you know, has insecurities and all of that. And still, she makes this enormous impact. So I feel like telling the story of flesh and blood human beings who raise kids, navigate relationships, et cetera, deal with their own, you know, humanity, is a way to kind of make us all feel that we can play a role in history and that we can do more than we think we can do, or what we're doing has the potential to make a greater impact than we might feel in all of our, you know, smallness on the planet, you know. So I think that's another thing about biography, that it's certainly not the message that one individual alone can change anything, you know. Everybody who changed something, Mariam Kaba has this thing, anything worth doing is, you have to be doing it with other people. So changing the world is definitely that. So she was immersed in communities and organizations, etc. But she herself was a complicated person that had problems and contradictions. And then she was also brilliant. So I don't know if that's a little bit of a rambling answer to your question.
This question is
a
live
stream. Okay.
Yvonne King, they asked, could you talk more about how Islanda led an interview with Mahatma Gandhi in 1931? Was she acting as a freelance journalist, or was she representing a paper or a magazine or what?
Yeah, I don't even remember the details of that myself. She was a freelance journalist. I think it was through some contacts that she got access to Gandhi when he was traveling, and managed to sit down and have this interview. It was pretty, you know, that, another example of her being kind of at the precipice of all of these historical moments and in the presence of all of these figures whose names are, you know, now, you know, common names. But interesting question. Things people zero in on. Yeah, but that, I'd almost forgotten that, actually. Yeah. Hi.
Thank you for this great conversation. I'm excited to begin to look at it. But I was interested in what you were, you know, talking about our travels on the continent and also later on. Could you say a little more about her involvement? Yeah, I know you mentioned like the Spanish Civil War, but her involvement in the Italian invasion of Ethiopia
Yeah, I mean, well, she travels to her first trip to Africa when she's living in London. She takes her then 10-year-old son with her. It is right around the time that Italy invades Ethiopia. She doesn't, you know, she's not particularly involved in the various South, you know, Harlem and in London and other places. There are movements and demonstrations that protest the invasion, but she's not involved in those. At that point, she is on her way to South Africa, where she spent some time, and then to Uganda. So not directly involved in that, but certainly later, as she, you know, comes to understand the gravity of that invasion, she speaks out about it. Yeah. Yeah, you get seconds.
A method question. Can you talk about, I know you mentioned that you first wrote an article in college, but if someone is interested in writing a biography, you talk about the resources and the time and perhaps even how you organize your materials in order to write this book. Mm-hmm. What does it take?
Wow. About 10 years. I don't know. I think I'm doing better at that because, you know, I mean, in some ways, a life provides a kind of more orderly entree to a topic, right? When was she born? What happened? And, you know, you kind of follow it chronologically. And I did think about other ways of organizing it. I don't know what you're thinking in terms of Winnie Mandela. I mean, you can talk about a life thematically, but we knew so little of her life. I just wanted to kind of lay it out in the process of also offering an analysis. I mean, you know, there's the collection period and the question asking period. I first had to approach her family, who were very protective of the papers. The son, Paul Robeson Jr., was finishing his own book about his father. So I kind of had to work around that. So the papers weren't completely open. And then I had to find out where supplemental papers were, which was the archives that I mentioned. And so, you know, I collect, and my method is I write things as I collect, understanding that that's very preliminary. So I'm not writing chapters, but I'm writing my reaction to the sources. And also, you know, each source has the potential to give you leads to other sources, right? So you see a letter and it refers to a meeting and you're like, oh, she was at that meeting. So then you go to the, you know, papers of someone who was also at that meeting to try to locate the person and so forth. So, you know, again, I was fortunate with this book in that she had diaries. So at least this is what she said she thought and felt at the time, including a few unkind words for various people who she didn't think too highly of at the moment. So it felt candid, but I also was a little bit cautious that this is the subject speaking to me. And so, that has to be filtered through what her interest was in telling, you know, in writing something down that she knew would likely be found later. So, yeah, I guess if there's a method, that's it, to kind of the kind of immersion in the primary sources, trying to keep track of my reaction to them as I go, and then assembling it all later and being prepared to write and rewrite many times.
But also, I mean, and something that is not always the case, but in this case, Eslanda had, as she said, a well-preserved life. So, I mean, she was a prolific journaler and, you know, had diaries and things like that. And also was a writer herself. So was constantly, you know, generating this information, this material. And I'm just thinking about a very different experience with Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who on the one hand was iconic and in many ways larger than life, but surprisingly doesn't have a very big archive. Mm-hmm. There are multiple reasons for that, you know, being under various banning orders where, you know, she couldn't be published or she couldn't speak in public and various other things. And I'm still trying to figure it all out, but also looking for all these alternative spaces. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it would, and I know you're having so much material poses another set of problems.
Yeah. What's important and what isn't. Right. And as with Winnie Mandela and Eslanda and Ella Baker, the interesting women are targets of government surveillance. Mm-hmm. So there are government documents about, you know, all of these subjects as well, which, you know, have to be viewed with a grain of salt, of course, but can also tell stories. Yeah. Sometimes stories that the subjects didn't know, right. You know.
So government records that are or may not be available yet, but, you know, you have to get access to, but also often government-controlled media.
Yeah.
So it's being framed through a perspective that's quite hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Peter.
I want to ask the historian to speculate about the future. But not the future from now, the past future that Eslanda did live to experience, participate in, and influence. So with the deep knowledge that you have about how she evolved during her own life, what do you think would have been her priorities during the decades that came after she became ill and then died, what would she have embraced? What would she have rejected? And I don't want to talk about Ukraine.
No. I mean, it's hard to speculate, you know, too much with a subject because people take so many turns, right? But she dies in 65. And it's such a pivotal moment when the anti-colonial movement in Africa is taking off, right? You know, we've new African. She did go to Ghana in 1958, 1 year after independence.
Just as an example of the places she was, the All-African People's Convention.
Historic convention. So she made it there. But to both see the victories and the defeats of many of the movements and ideological political movements and freedom movements that she was a part of, I think there would have been some disappointment there. Mm-hmm. I think she would have, you know, she was enormously resilient, though. I think she would have, cheered on groups like the Black Panthers and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I think she would have cheered on the many millions of people who hit the streets after George Floyd's murder in 2020. And, so she was somebody who was she was drawn to people fighting back and fighting around, you know, issues of justice. And so I think she would have been a keen observer of what happened next. And it's to die in 19, it's no good time to die, but 1965 was the precipice of so much. Mm-hmm. I have thought about that. What would have been her trajectory. And also it was a time, the last number of years of their relationship, Paul was in decline health-wise. And so she, for example, she meets Martin Luther King in London, and Paul is not well enough to be there. So she does that on her own. So I think her own independence, had she lived 10 more years, might have been greater than it had been for most of her adult life. Yeah, but thank you for that question, Dr. Spohr.
There's another question online.
Okay.
Two questions, actually. One, both about her politics. Uh-huh. So one is a question about in what ways did she contribute to Paul's radicalism, and how did he contribute to hers?
Good question.
Uh-huh. And then from the list of historic events that she was present for, do you think any of those in particular had more of an impact than any of the other ones? Mm-hmm.
Those must be historians. So how did she radicalize Paul and how did he radicalize her? She really, they were both interested. He was interested in African culture. He was very proficient at languages, and he often sang in, other languages as sort of gesture of his artistic internationalism. But she was the one who met some of the people in London before he did, people who were, from Kenya, Nigeria, Southern Africa, and so forth. And so she did introduce him to some of those people. I think they had a lot of intense political discussions and debates about what was happening in the world. I think she gave him confidence. I mean, we see him as this grand solitary figure, this unwavering person of principle, but, they came home together every night and talked about, we're under siege in the world or what's happening in the world. And they had very much of an intellectual relationship. So as intellectual and political relationship. So I think she radicalized him by being a partner in, exploring freedom movements in the world, by exploring the world. And then I want to say around gender issues as well, because they did have a struggle inside their marriage. Around the terms of the marriage. And it wasn't just around, infidelity or whether he was going to have other sexual partners, but he was the main income earner, but she was often the not unofficially a part of the team, but wasn't getting the paychecks, let's say. And so there was a point at which they were living separately and she was getting money. And she didn't feel it was enough. And then there was, like a struggle around that. So, and then he conceded, yes, you're right. And they changed the arrangement. So I think she probably brought him down a notch or two in terms of humility in the work that they were doing together in ways that probably no one else could have. The second question is, what were the events that might have transformed her more than others? I think seeing war firsthand, going to Spain during the Spanish Civil War, they went to provide support to the anti-fascist forces there. But she, the person who was their driver while they were there, she develops a lifelong relationship with and visits him and his family in Mexico many years later. And she wrote a very long manuscript about her experiences in Spain, you know, during the war of, you know, just, you know, seeing the ravages of war, but also talking to enormously heroic and brave people, some of whom weren't even Spanish, who had gone there in different solidarity brigades to fight on the side of the anti-fascists against Franco. So I think that had an enormous impact on her. And of course, you know, her first trip to Africa, she said, my mind opened up, you know, and she juxtaposed her experience of talking about politics and change and ideas in Africa, in a place where, you know, white supremacist stereotypes would have you think people are not having these sophisticated conversations. And she was challenged there intellectually in ways that I think surprised her and transformed her. So I say those two experiences. Yeah. And some people really listening carefully on the live stream.
Just to add, there's so many things you could add. So people should definitely
read the book.
I haven't read the book.
I haven't reread the book in many years. So
no, but she was irrepressible. I mean, and a lot. How long was she living with cancer? I mean, she had
quite a number of years.
Yeah. But ran for office under the Progressive Party ticket. I mean, there were just so many things that tried to write. Fiction.
She did write fiction. Yeah. She didn't get it published, but she did write it. She wrote plays. She wrote novels.
She was. But it's almost kind of frenetic. Almost, mm-hmm. You're like, she's constantly producing things, and they either work or they don't. But I'm just wondering if you thought about like where did that drive come from? It's just.
I mean, I think she was a driven person. I think she was a hungry person. For experiences, for outlets, for her energy and creativity. She was constantly. And she also, in addition to being a diarist and a writer and journalist, she also was a letter writer. You know, she wrote letters to people, like very long letters, you know, and they're kind of works of art too, you know, describing and being in a train station in Berlin and all the things that happened and the nuance of this and the feeling she had about the climate and describing, you know, driving and or visiting a mining compound in Southern Africa when she was there and so forth. So in her letters too, they become another outlet for not only building relationships and networks, but just literary expression. Yeah. I don't know where that comes from, you know, in a person. I will say this, you know, in talking about biography, I'm working on something now, which is not a biography, but the third book I did was a kind of collective biography in part of some of the amazing, you know, young Black feminists in the movement for Black lives, including Charlene. But thinking of biography again makes me think of a little bit of tension between both my politics, Ella Baker's politics, and the kind of the way in which biography risks exalting the individual in ways that politically I think is dangerous. But again, I hope that I embed the person enough in the larger work that they're doing in the communities that they're a part of and the time that they lived, you know, that doesn't come across as a message of how we should view history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Are there any more questions there?
That's it.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was
and we look forward to your book on Winnie Mandela.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe we'll sit here and have another conversation. But that's, and just also kudos to Haymarket. Just honored to be in the company of all the amazing authors that are on Haymarket's list every year. So you know, Beth Ritchie and Angela Davis and Erica Miner and Gina Dent, of course, most recent book, and I'm sure others, and I should be mentioning right now that I'm not thinking of, but it's very special that that Haymarket has uplifted this project and so many others, and we appreciate y'all.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.